All right, let's turn to 2 Samuel as we continue the saga. David's life is unfolding in very dramatic ways here. He's seeing the results of some of the bad decisions that he has made early in his life, and they're starting to manifest themselves in the consequences that he sees. And so we saw last time, the last couple of weeks, we went over the narrative regarding Amnon, David's eldest son, and his rape of his own half-sister, Tamar. Well, that introduced a huge amount of animosity between Tamar's brother, full brother, whose name was Absalom. That's David's third son. As we said, Amnon's the first son, Absalom's the third. The one in the middle is named Kileab. We read about him in the genealogical list, but he's never mentioned anywhere else. So there's a good chance that Kileab died very young. And so you have Amnon, and after him in line for the throne, Absalom. And now there's this huge animosity between them because of what Amnon did to Tamar. Well, as we read last week, Absalom executed a plan of vengeance. Took him 2 years to plot it out and carry it through. And that was to kill Amnon. So he invites his whole house, his father's house, all the servants of the palace, all of the king's sons and their households, to a sheep shearing party that he was having. It was a pretty normal event in the lives of the shepherds of Israel. And so David refuses to go. The servants of the palace, David's not going to send along, but he says, your brothers, they can go with you. Have fun. So while they're all there, Absalom commands one of his servants to kill Amnon, which happens. And so Amnon is dead, and Absalom has fled to his grandfather's house in Geshur. I brought the map up here so we can just take a quick look at what we're talking about. Of course, this is Israel. It's not quite too easy to see with all those names on there, so let me shrink things. You probably recognize the Dead Sea down here in the south and the Sea of Galilee up here in the north. And the Jordan River flows down in the lowlands here in this dark shaded area. This whole area is a valley that is very deep. Tall mountains, big flatland over here to the east that we know as the land of Goshen, big mesa that rises up on the east side. And to the west, Israel, very mountainous here in Ephraim and down in Judah, very mountainous area, and even up in Galilee, lots and lots of mountains. They wouldn't be mountains by the comparison of like the Rockies. They'd be, they're something like the Appalachian Trail. They're not super, super tall, but they're nice kind of rolling mountains, but they're not small hills either. So you can have some deep valleys running between them. Jerusalem, situated right about here, down where the hand is at. And so Absalom took his brothers to the sheep shearing party, which was up north right about here in Ephraim. That's where he kills Amnon. He begins to flee immediately from there. He doesn't go back to Jerusalem to see what's going to happen, to see what David will do to him. He runs, and he runs up north to Geshur, which is right here on the east side of the Sea of Galilee. Geshur was a small kingdom. It's mentioned in the book of Joshua that the Israelites were not able to drive the Geshurites out of the land, and so they dwelt in the land even up until David's day. David had somewhat subjugated them. They brought tribute to Israel, but they were still an independent kingdom. And so when Absalom flees there to his grandfather, his mother's dad, he's given asylum, and David can't pursue him. As we said, David, what should David have been seeking to do with Absalom? According to God's law, what should he have been doing? And as king? Well, that kick him out of Israel was one option. And executing him was the other option. Okay, dads, how many of you would be able to carry out that command? We can have some understanding to David. As king, it was his responsibility to execute God's law against all the people within his kingdom. And he was not supposed to have any favoritism towards anybody, including his own sons. But you can imagine that, fathers. I lost my screen, didn't I? It just shut off. Rats. You can imagine how difficult that would be for David to have to try and put his son through a murder trial and then have him executed. But that was the law that God prescribed. God also said, the wording is that they will be cut off from their people. So that can mean execution. Banishment was another means of effecting the punishment. And so David at this point leaves it alone because Absalom has been banished from the land. He's no longer living in Israel. He's living up in Geshur. So we'll go ahead and close that up since we don't need it. But that's some of the topography of the land, and it'll come into play just a little in what we look at today. So tonight we're looking at a false reconciliation, because this split in the family has been going on for some time. We read that Absalom, verse 37 of chapter 13, fled and went to Talmai, the son of Ammihud, king of Geshur. In verse 38, so Absalom fled and went to Geshur and was there for 3 years. Now, how long was Absalom plotting against Tamar? Not Tamar. Amnon. 2 years. So you've got 2 years in the plotting of the event. You've got 3 years that Absalom's in exile. We're going to have another time span here, but that gives us 5 years. So a lot of time has passed since the beginning of chapter 13. We've got at least 5 years here, all right? So it's at the end of this 3 years of Absalom's exile, chapter 14, verse 1, Joab, the son of Zeruiah, knew that the king's heart went out to Absalom. There's an interesting translational question here, because the preposition that is translated in all of our English translations as to Absalom almost never means towards. It is almost always translated with the sense of against. Now, what would the difference be there? Did the king's heart go towards Absalom, or did it go against Absalom? Does that make a difference? Yeah, it sure does. And so it's kind of a tricky question to deal with in this text, and it can kind of change how you look at what's happening here, because Joab knows that the king's heart went out in some way towards Absalom, whether towards him or against him, and that's what's motivating Joab to take the steps that he does. To be honest, it can kind of make sense either way, and this is one of those issues that scholars sit around in their classrooms and talk about all day long and try to come up with answers to. And the short answer is, so there's the short answer. If it means that the heart of the king went out towards Absalom, then David's yearning to have his son return to him, right? He's yearning towards Absalom. And he wants Absalom to come back. So the question is, if you're familiar with this passage, we're going to do a little bit of a spoiler here. You know that Joab convinces David to bring Absalom back, but David then doesn't see Absalom for 2 years. So if the heart of David was reaching out to Absalom and yearning to return him, then why does he take 2 years before he even sees him? If the heart of David is going out against Absalom, and he's wanting to capture him and bring him back to justice, as it were, to do something about the murder, well, then you have a very different scenario, because then Joab is trying to convince David to relent. So, is Joab trying to help David reach out to Absalom, or is Joab trying to convince David to relent of his anger against Absalom? Interesting question, isn't it? All right? Now, you got to love these sorts of things in Scripture. They're lots of fun to think about and deal with, and sometimes you just have to think through what would the implications be of saying it one way or the other, okay? It's the same thing in verse 39 of chapter 13 when the spirit of the king longed to go out, all right, to Absalom. It's the same preposition there, and it could mean against, almost, it could mean over, it usually means over or upon. It almost never means towards, but it can mean against. So you're looking at over, on, against, But for some reason, all of our English translations in these two instances render it as David's heart was longing to reach out to Absalom. Okay, and so part of me wants to just side with the translators and say they probably know a whole lot more about Hebrew than I do. And so we'll go with that. Part of me wants to explore the possibility, because we know that translations don't always get it right, do they? Occasionally they get it wrong. And so it is an interesting thing to look at. So at any rate, I think, here's my uninformed opinion, I think that it really does mean that David's heart was yearning to reconcile. Because the one thing that sways me the most is, what does David do when Absalom dies? Yeah. Oh, huge mourning. So much, in fact, that Joab has to rebuke him and say, if you don't stand up and congratulate your army for winning, everybody's going to leave. Because you're acting like it's such a bad thing that Absalom died. So that kind of lends me to saying that David wants to reconcile with Absalom, and yet he knows that he can't fully because of what Absalom's done. Right, and so that also explains the two-year gap, but we'll get to that here. So I think the king's heart's going out to Absalom, and he wants to reconcile with him. So Joab is going to try and help things along. Verse 2, Joab sent to Tekoa and brought from there a wise woman and said to her, pretend to be a mourner and put on mourning garments. That's not like sunrising garments, okay? This is mourning, sad, black. Wear your veil, sackcloth, torn, put ashes on. Do not anoint yourself with oil, but behave like a woman who has been mourning many days for the dead. So, behaving like a woman who has been mourning many days, when he says don't anoint your head to oil, think to yourself, don't take a shower. Because when you come into the presence of David, it needs to be very apparent that you have not been carrying on life as normal. You're mourning, you're sad, right? So don't anoint your head with oil. That was how they cleaned themselves up. That's how they kept the fragrances in the right places, okay? And so don't anoint your head with oil. It means come into the presence of the king. You're going to be looking like you haven't been taking care of yourself for a very long time because you've been mourning for the dead. Go to the king and speak thus to him. So Joab put the words in her mouth. So everything that we're going to read out of this gal's mouth is coming from Joab. He's the one that's instructing her in what to say, because he wants to pull a little bit of a shenanigan here on David, and we'll see what's happening here. Basically, Joab is trying to do what Nathan did. You remember when Nathan came to David, and he didn't just outright break the doors down and say, David, now look at what you've done. He gave him the story first to get David thinking about it. Well, Joab's trying the same tactic. Except, what do we know about the difference between Joab and Nathan? Yeah, Joab is not the greatest character in the world, right? He has not shown himself to be the best morally upstanding kind of guy. So, is there a difference between a wise approaching of a tough subject and a potential manipulation? Yeah, there is, okay? Nathan's trying to broach a very difficult subject. You're going in to accuse the king of murder. Do you need to handle that carefully? You probably better. And you want to make sure he's a king that has shown himself to be sensitive to God's rule, and so you want to take that route, but you also have to be careful. And so Nathan's being careful. Joab's being manipulative. He's bringing this lady in. He's going to try and manipulate David, and we're going to see how that plays out in the following verses. So when the woman of Tekoa came to the king, she fell on her face to the ground, which was the normal sign of respect and submission to your sovereign. She paid homage and said, save me, O king! So, save me from what? Well, we're going to find out. We got to remember, every time you see that word save, it's not talking about eternal salvation, right? So you have to be careful within your context to determine what does she need saved from. She's going to tell us that. This context seems pretty obvious, but there are other contexts that aren't so obvious, like in 2 Peter, where it says baptism saves you. Does baptism save you? But it says baptism saves you. So we can't just say baptism doesn't save you, right? We have to be careful and say baptism does save you, but from what? Is the question. Okay? So the scriptures clearly say baptism saves you, so you can't come in and say baptism doesn't save you. You have to clarify. What are you talking about? What kind of salvation are we talking about? Because not every time does it mention saving, does it mean eternal salvation. So that context, Peter says baptism saves you from an evil conscience. And so because you know you've done what God wants you to do, does God command us to be baptized? Yes, he does. So should we follow in that? Yes, we should. And if we don't, are there consequences to that? Yes, there are. So in that sense, baptism saves you. Well, this woman says, save me, O King. So she's not talking about eternal salvation, but she says, I have this issue that needs to be dealt with. You're the king. You're the supreme judge of Israel. They didn't have separation of powers in the Davidic kingdom under the Old Testament law. So David was both, or I should say David was all, the executive, legislative, and judicial branch of government, right? He made the laws, he enforced the laws, and he decided whether the laws were just or not. We don't tend to like that kind of arrangement these days, but we've got to remember we're working under a different economy, aren't we? This is God's anointed man, and this is God's kingdom that he's working over. So she's going to him, he's the supreme judge. Save me, O king. And the king said to her, what is your trouble? Lay the case out before me. And she says, alas, I am a widow. My husband is dead. Those are important details to remember here because it, for the most part, means she has nobody to help her. The presence of the husband was necessary for legal proceedings. If the husband was dead, that meant some other man had to take care of her court cases, had to be the provider for her. She would not have been a wealthy person. She would not have been a very influential person. And so she needs some help. She needs someone to step in. It is also a very good emotional argument, isn't it? Because who's going to want to rule against a widow? Right? I always get a kick out of, we watch these TV shows like Shark Tank. Anybody watch this? So, you know, they go in front of these group of rich people and they're asking for money to start a business. So Gary wants to expand and build, you know, four new factories on there and get up to 1,400 units a year, and he needs money to build a building. So he goes in front of the Shark Tanks. He tells them his idea. He says, I want so much money and I'm going to sell you such a percentage of my company to get it. And then they go back and forth, and the sharks almost always take over the company completely, and you wind up with your money and you think it's great, right? So, but anyway, a lot of times people will go in there and they'll start asking financial questions. What's it worth? How many sales have you had? How much debt do you have? How much of this company do you own? This and that. And a lot of times the person will start crying. And they'll say, I've worked so hard that I'm going to keep going. I'm going to keep plugging away and nothing's going to stop me from achieving my dreams. And drives me nuts. Because I'm not a completely unsentimental guy. I cry, you know, at the end of sad movies, I cry. But in situations like that, I think, come on, you're going for the sympathy vote here. If you say see tears, you're hoping they'll be more lenient to you and give you more money and take less of your company. It never works. Never works, by the way. But that's what she's doing here. I'm a widow woman. I need your help. My husband is dead. This is the sympathy argument. And your servant had two sons, and they quarreled with one another in the field. And there was no one to separate them, and the one struck the other and killed him. This becomes a problem. You're a widow, so you have no husband. All you had were two sons to take care of you. Now you have one son. Because he killed the other one. But now what's the problem? I've got one son, and now he's a wanted man. He's a murderer. We're going to look at some details of this, okay? David doesn't ask a lot of questions in this. So he gets duped a little bit by this scenario here. He does ask a few questions, but here's the real problem. I'm a widow. One of my sons killed the other son, verse 7, and now the whole clan has risen against your servant, and they say, give up the man who struck his brother, that we may put him to death for the life of his brother whom he killed. That is commanded by Numbers chapter 35. When God is giving the law regarding murders, it was required that whoever murdered, that person would be put to death on the evidence of two or three witnesses, and that was the only way to cleanse the land from the guilt of bloodshed, was by the execution of the murderer. All right. So the nearest of kin to the murdered person would be the, I just lost the term for the attorney that, the prosecutor. The attorney that prosecutes, what's the name of that person? Boy, the prosecuting attorney. So the nearest of kin would bring the charges and would go hunt down the guy and bring him into custody and then bring the charges and then the trial would happen. And then if he was declared guilty, the nearest of kin would be the first one to throw the stone, would be the first one to execute the judgment. So she's saying the whole clan, the whole family is rising up against me and they want to put my other son to death. And so here's her problem. They would destroy the heir also. All right, you got two sons. One's dead from the murder, the other one's left. He's the last one to claim the inheritance. So if they put him to death, what happens? Her whole inheritance is lost because she's a widow. She can't have any more sons. Her inheritance, her husband's inheritance, the land, would revert to the next nearest of kin, which would be the people trying to put her son to death. A little bit of a conflict of interest, right? Okay. So they would destroy the heir also. Thus they would quench my coal that is left and leave to my husband neither name nor remnant on the face of the earth. Now, that's a pretty big deal. To leave a name unrepresented in Israel is a big deal. Why do you think they took such pains to record all the names of people throughout the genealogies? Because it was important. To let them know that that name is continuing on. That household, that lineage is still going through history. It's present. It's represented. And so to completely eliminate a man's name from the nation of Israel was a big deal. It signified that he had been completely removed from a place of blessing. And so nobody wanted that to happen. And so she says, if they execute my other son, my husband will have nothing left. There'll be no one to claim his inheritance, and his name will be removed from the rosters. And so that is her issue. She says they'll quench my coal. And that's the picture of, anybody go camping much? We got any campers among us other than my family? What's that? Years past, yeah. So, you know, you go camping, and you build your fire Friday night, and if you're staying till Sunday, especially if you were in the Cub Scouts, Dan could tell us about this when they go on campouts. When I was a Cub Scout and we'd go on campout, they gave us two matches, and that had to keep our fire going all weekend. So you'd use one of those matches to get your fire going if you could, and you'd make sure to get it good and hot Friday night so that Saturday morning, what's still in the fire pit? Hot coals. So that you can just put a couple of shavings of wood or newspaper in there and you blow on them and it revives, right? She's saying, this son of mine, he's that hot coal. Through him, my line can be rekindled. He can get married. He can bear children, hopefully more sons, and they can have sons. And then my husband's name will be spread again. He's the coal that can rekindle the fire of my family name, right? So if they do, very picturesque language, very picturesque. If they do that, they're squelching that coal, they're putting it out, they're stomping on the fire, and it will never be lit again. We had a friend back in Salina that, what was it, no boys had been born into the family for how long? Since the Revolutionary War. Was it no boys or no girls? So, okay, that was no, never mind, that doesn't fit at all. I was backwards. Yeah, so. But, you know, we don't have quite that trouble. I have me and my brother to carry on my dad's name, and of course my brother's got a son and I have four sons, so the Kelly name's going to continue on for quite a while here. That flame's burning pretty hot. But it does happen occasionally. Someone only has daughters or their sons die before they're able to have children, and it happens that the name is extinguished, and that was a very big deal. So this is the argumentation that she's using to try and win David over to her side. So obviously, what is it that she wants? Help. Yeah, David, help me stop them from executing my son. She wants a presidential pardon of her son because of these extenuating circumstances, right? And so there are some questions that David should be asking here. According to God's law, murderers had to be executed, but what did you have to have? Two witnesses. Okay, so do we have two witnesses against this? She hasn't told us, so we don't know. But David should be asking that. Anybody else see this? Okay. Well, they were fighting out in the field. Numbers chapter 35 is good guidance for us on what God's law required, and it was that if two men were fighting and one of them struck the other so that they died, but there was no previous evil intent, that the man's not guilty of murder if they're just fighting and they hit each other. If you pick up a weapon, that's a different story, and it's pretty specific. You pick up an instrument of iron or of wood or a rock and you kill the other person, that's murder. But if you're just fighting and you strike the guy and he dies, that's not. And so you had to look at a couple of things. Was there intention to kill? Was there premeditation to kill? And David doesn't ask any of those questions. He doesn't ask any of those things, but he perceives that this woman... I'm getting ahead of myself. So he doesn't ask any of those questions, but look what he tells her in verse 8. Then the king said to the woman, "Go to your house and I will give orders concerning you." Now what does that mean? Well, he's actually decided. So what he's saying is, go home, I will send orders regarding you, nobody will touch your son. That's the implication that's going on here. It's not that he has to think about it a little bit more. My kids accuse me that sometimes when I say I'll think about it, actually means I'm never going to bring it up again. And they tease me about it because, I don't know, I guess... Sometimes they ask for something, and I don't feel like thinking about it at the moment, so I pass them off a little bit, and then it completely slips my mind. But that's not what David is doing here. He is saying, "I'll give orders concerning you. I will put a wall of protection, a legal wall of protection around you." So the other thing that David is not asking, he doesn't ask any of the questions surrounding the case. He's just given a judgment. That's a bad idea, isn't it? Proverbs warns us about making decisions without hearing all sides of things because it tells us the first person that comes to present their case always seems right until you cross-examine, until you listen to the other side. So how often have you heard somebody come to you and say, "This person did this to me," and da-da-da-da-da, and you think, "Wow, that sounds really bad," right? And then you hear the other person's side of it. They say, "Well, boy, this is bad on both sides," right? So David's not asking any questions for some reason. And maybe it's because he's so emotionally tied up about what happened with Absalom, but he's not performing the duties of a judge by just passing these judgments without asking questions. There was also a provision in the law regarding what were called cities of refuge. There were six cities scattered throughout Israel. One of them was Shechem, which was just a few miles north of Jerusalem. One was Hebron, which was about 20 miles south of Jerusalem. Those were cities of refuge so that if you accidentally killed somebody and the avenger of blood, which is the nearest of kin that we talked about, was chasing you, you were supposed to flee to the city of refuge. And if you could make it within the walls of the city of refuge, you were safe. Those walls protected you. And as long as you never left those walls, you could not be extradited for trial. If... it was unpremeditated. See, what was supposed to happen was you go to the city of refuge, you present your case to the elders of the city. You tell them, "I killed a guy accidentally and his brother's after me, he wants to kill me. So if the avenger of blood catches you and kills you, he's not guilty of murder." That's avenging the blood, right? If you get into the city of refuge, you present your case to the elders, and then the avenger of blood comes, and he petitions the city of elders to have you released to him. They were supposed to hear your case and make a decision and say, "Well, it doesn't sound like you wanted to kill the guy. You didn't use a weapon. You didn't want him dead beforehand, so this was an accidental murder, or an accidental killing." It wouldn't be murder then, would it? It was an accidental killing, so you are... you're granted asylum within the walls of the city. You could live the rest of your life within the walls of that city, completely protected, until the death of the high priest. So whoever is reigning as the high priest at the time, when he died, you were completely free to go home. Until he died, you had to stay inside that city. If you left the walls of the city and the avenger of blood found you, he could execute you and he would not be guilty. So that was the setup to protect people against accidental murders, to protect them against vengeance. So these are questions that David's not asking. Now, we've seen throughout David's life, he's a man that knows God's law. So why he isn't asking these questions, we're not sure, but it's going to lead him into trouble because he's going to be manipulated by this woman. All right? So we're probably going to have to leave things right there for this week. There's the situation. She's presented this case. She's used a lot of very strong emotional arguments to try and woo David over to her side. The fact that she's a widow, the fact that this is her last remaining son, her husband's name will be banished and extinguished in Israel, and so she wants David to give orders concerning her, which he has done. But she's going to continue on with this because she's not quite content with that answer because it doesn't give her enough control. Right? Okay? She's trying to manipulate him, which we'll see. So, any questions about any of that?